Welcome to Base by Base. You know, in genomics today, it feels like we're drowning in data sometimes, which is great, right? These huge data sets, they hold so many keys, especially for complex diseases.
Absolutely. But there's a catch. Having the data is one thing, actually using it effectively, turning that potential into, well, real understanding that hits a computational wall pretty fast.
Exactly. And that's what we're digging into today. How do you handle this flood, especially for something really promising like polygenic risk scores?
That's the core question, isn't it? Scaling up our methods. And there's this fascinating piece of research we're going to explore that tackles this head on.
Okay, yeah. We're looking at a paper from 2025 published in the American Journal of Human Genetics. It's by Shadi Zabad and colleagues. And they went right after the big computational problems in calculating these polygenic risk scores, PRSs, from whole genome data.
Precisely. PRSs are, well, they're becoming super valuable. They help quantify the genetic side of traits and diseases by looking at potentially millions of tiny effects across the genome.
Like summing up all those little nudges from your DNA.
Exactly. But doing that sum accurately and efficiently, when you've got millions, maybe tens of millions, of these genetic variants, that's been a massive computational bottleneck. It's really limited what researchers could do and how fast.
So Zabad and colleagues, their mission was basically make whole genome PRS fast and less memory hungry.
That's the goal. Develop the algorithms, the data structures needed to break through those limitations. So let's unpack how they did it and, you know, what it means for the field.
All right, let's treat this like we're reading their paper. First up, the context, the objectives.
Yeah.
What was the big hairy problem they were trying to solve?
Okay, so the fundamental challenge is scaling PRS inference, making it work with the full detail of modern genomic data. At its heart, calculating a PRS, mathematically, it's a bit like a huge multiple regression problem. You're trying to estimate the effect size for millions of variants all at once.
And the data we get from GOEs from sequencing, it's just enormous now.
Oh, yeah. Tens of millions of variants, that's pretty standard. But it's not just the raw variant data. A really critical piece for accurate PRS methods is what's called a linkage disequilibrium reference panel, LD for short.
Right, LD. That's about how variants tend to be inherited together in chunks, isn't it?
You got it. They travel together on the chromosome. And you need that LD info because it helps the model figure out the real effects of variants that are close together and, you know, often show up together.
Ah, okay. So you don't accidentally double count the effect from variants in the same block.
That's a perfect way to put it. Without handling LD, you'd definitely run into that problem. But here's the kicker. Using that LD information usually means building and working with this enormous LD matrix. It maps out the correlations between all the pairs of variants.
And that's the computational nightmare everyone talks about.
That is absolutely where the pain starts. Millions of variants mean the matrix size just explodes. It grows quadratically. Trying to store it the straightforward way, you're talking tens of gigs, maybe even terabytes. Way too big for most computers' RAM.
Terabytes. Okay.
And then actually processing it during the PRS calculation, super intensive. It can take hours, even for like the standard HapMap3 set, which is only about 1.4 million variants.
So the LD matrix is bottleneck number one. Huge size, intense calculations. Were there other headaches they mentioned?
Yeah, a couple of others. Things like numerical instabilities. Sometimes the estimated LD matrix isn't perfectly mathematically nice, and that can mess up the calculations. And also differences between the population you did your GWAS in and the population used for the LD reference panel, that can cause issues too.
Gotcha. So huge data, a monster LD matrix, potential math problems.
Yeah.
That paints a clear picture. Okay, method section then. How did Shadi Zabad and colleagues actually fix this? This paper was an update to their earlier VIPRS software, right?
That's right. VIPRS Variational Inference of Polygenic Risk Scores. And this new version, V0.1, it packs several really key innovations, starting with, well, probably the most crucial bit, taming that giant LD matrix.
How on earth did they make that manageable?
They got clever with storage. A new compressed format. First off, the matrix is symmetric. The correlation between variant A and B is the same as B and A. So they just stored one half, the upper triangular part.
Simple, but smart. Cuts the storage almost in half right there.
More than half, yeah. Then the big step, they slashed the precision of the numbers they stored. Instead of using standard 64-bit floating point numbers, which are very precise but take up space, they looked at using 32-bit floats.
Okay, less precision.
And even further, they found they could often use 16-bit or even 8-bit integers using this neat trick called quantization.
Quantization? Sounds like making things blockier. Does it mean losing information?
A little bit, yes. Essentially, you scale the correlation value by some factor, then round it to the nearest integer. Think of it like saving a photo as a lower quality JPEG instead of a huge TIFF file. You lose tiny details, but for this calculation, that loss is often negligible and the space saving is huge.
Okay, so how much space did that actually save them?
Well, putting the triangular storage together with this lower precision quantization, it led to really massive savings. They reported over 50-fold reductions in storage needs, that HapMap 3 plus LD matrix, about 1.4 million variants. They could shrink it down to as little as 300 megabytes.
300 megs? Down from potentially tens of gigabytes. That's incredible. Makes sharing and using these things way easier.
Totally. And how they stored it is also key. They used the compressed sparse row format, CSR, which is efficient, and crucially, they integrated it with something called ZAR storage.
ZAR, I've heard of that. Isn't that for chunked data, good for cloud computing?
Exactly, that's the key. It stores the matrix in manageable chunks. So if you're doing calculations, you only need to load the chunks you're actually working on right now. Perfect for parallel processing, great for the cloud, and they even layered Z-standard compression on top of ZAR for like up to another 4x squeeze in some cases.
What? Okay, so they tackled the storage footprint head on, but the other half is the calculation speed, right? How do they speed up the actual algorithms?
Right, that was innovation number two. The main engine of VIPRS is this iterative calculation called coordinate ascent. It can chew up like 80% of the runtime, so they went after that.
Rewriting the slow parts in a faster language, I bet.
You guessed it. They rewrote that core coordinate ascent loop in CC++, standard practice for speeding things up in science software, moving away from Python for the heavy lifting. Plus, they used optimized linear algebra libraries, things like BLAS and SIMD instructions.
SIMD. That's doing multiple calculations at once on the processor level.
Correct. Single instruction, multiple data, lets you process small vectors of numbers in parallel. Perfect for matrix math. They also switched to using lower precision numbers, float 32, just for the intermediate steps and parameters. It's faster, uses less memory than the super precise float 64, and didn't hurt the final accuracy.
Okay, makes sense. And memory usage during the calculation. Even with a compressed matrix, did they optimize that too?
They did. They developed two modes. One they call low memory, or triangular LD mode. Here, instead of like decompressing the whole relevant chunk of the LD matrix into full precision memory, the algorithm works directly on that compressed triangular data structure. Big reduction in peak memory needed right there.
And there was an even more extreme mode.
Yeah, something called dequantize on the fly, or DQF mode. This one's pretty slick. It keeps the LD matrix entries in their super compressed, quantized integer format. They only get dequantized back to higher precision right when they're needed for a specific calculation and then discarded.
Ah, so you never have large blocks of the high precision data sitting in memory.
Exactly. It minimizes the memory needed for the LD matrix itself, like up to another 8-fold reduction. There's a tiny bit of extra computation for the dequantizing, but the memory savings can be crucial.
Okay, fantastic. So revolutionary storage, much faster, much leaner algorithms. What about using multiple processors? Parallelism.
That's innovation three. Two levels here. First, inside that core coordinate ascent loop, they used multi-threading with OpenMP. So multiple threads work together on each iteration, speeding it up. And importantly, this works with any LD structure, not just nice independent blocks.
And the second level.
Processing whole chromosomes in parallel. Since the calculations for chromosome 1 are independent of chromosome 2 and so on, they just used a pool of processes to run each chromosome simultaneously. This gives huge speedups, they said, up to 2 orders of magnitude faster than their older versions just by doing this.
Nice. Okay, beyond the main calculation, what about tuning the model? Choosing the best settings, the hyperparameters, that can be slow too, right?
Definitely. And that was innovation 4. Things like tuning the parameter for, say, what proportion of variants you assume are actually causal for the trait. Usually you do this with cross-validation, needing separate training and validation data sets.
Which isn't always practical, getting those extra large data sets.
Exactly. So they built in a procedure called PUM-ACE. It cleverly generates realistic synthetic training and validation summary statistics directly from your original GWS results and the LD matrix you already have. No need for external validation data, just for tuning.
Oh, that's a huge practical plus. Did they speed up the tuning process itself?
Yep. They used what's called a pathwise grid search. The idea is when you're testing different parameter values, you use the result from the previous value as a smart starting point, a warm start for the next one. This makes the search much faster, cutting tuning time by about 30%.
Clever. Okay, one last innovation area, numerical stability. You mentioned weird LD matrices can cause problems.
Right. Innovation 5. This is super important. If your estimated LD matrix isn't mathematically positive semi-definite, which can happen due to estimation noise, missing data, or even the compression approximations, the iterative math can just go haywire. Parameter estimates can blow up, become totally unstable.
So you need guardrails, basically, to keep the math on track, even with messy real-world data.
Precisely. Their fix was to add a penalty term into the calculation. It's proportional to how bad the matrix is specifically to the size of the smallest negative eigenvalue. This penalty essentially reins in the parameter estimates, stops them from exploding.
Does that penalty affect the results? Make them less accurate?
It can, potentially. It might shrink the estimated effects a bit too much if the matrix is really problematic. They discuss this trade-off. They suggest maybe tuning that penalty level carefully if you have some validation data. But they also give practical tips for making better, more stable LD matrices to begin with. Things like how you handle missing data, using block structures, maybe using 16-bit integers instead of 8-bit. If stability is absolutely critical.
Wow, okay. That's a really comprehensive set of improvements. Storage, speed, memory, parallelism, tuning, stability. They hit everything. All right, let's move to results. How did all this perform in practice?
They really put it through its paces. They used data from the big Pan-UK Biobank project, looked at 75 different continuous traits known to be heritable, focusing on the large European ancestry group, and they tested it with increasingly dense variant sets. Started with HapMap3 plus Sun, about 1.4 million variants, then a set with 13.4 million variants, and finally, a really dense one with 18 million variants. Plus, they used data from another study, Cartagene, to check if the results held up across different biobanks.
Okay, massive testing ground. What were the headlines on performance? Storage, speed, memory?
The results were pretty staggering, actually. Validated all those methods nicely. For storage, that huge 18 million variant LD matrix, using their 8-bit integer compression, it took up only about 20 gigabytes. Compare that to, well, potentially over a terabyte for older methods storing fewer variants.
20 gigs instead of a terabyte. That's game-changing right there.
Yeah.
And the speed and memory for the actual calculation?
On the 1.4 million variant HapMap3 Plus set, this new VIPRS V0.1 was over 6 times faster than their previous version and used at least 3 times less memory. It finished in under a minute and used less than 800 megabytes of RAM.
Under a minute? Under a gig of RAM?
Yeah.
1.4 million variants. That is seriously efficient. What about the monster 18 million variant set?
Even on that huge data set, it finished the main calculation in less than an hour using under 15 gigs of RAM. Which is remarkable. They also compared it to other tools. On the HapMap3 set, VIPRS V0.1 was something like 80 times faster and used 35 times less memory than LDPred2. Compared to another state-of-the-art method, SBASE-RC, on a similar variant set, VIPRS was about 4 times faster and used 3 times less memory.
Okay, so dramatically faster and leaner than the competition, too.
Yeah, and even when SBASE-RC used a smaller 7 million variant set, VIPRS was still more memory efficient and finished faster while handling way more variants.
And the tuning part? VIPRS-GS. Still fast enough.
Yeah, I mean, adding the tuning does take longer, maybe 3 or 4 times the runtime of fitting just one model, but it was still way faster than Drexline methods that might not even offer that kind of integrated tuning. And the parallelism worked as expected. More cores meant faster runs.
Okay, so computationally, it's a slam dunk. Huge improvements. Now, the million-dollar question, prediction accuracy. Did using all those extra millions of variants actually lead to better, more accurate polygenic risk scores?
Right. This is probably one of the most interesting results and maybe slightly surprising. First off, VIPRS V0.1 achieved prediction accuracy that was right up there, comparable to the best methods available, like SBASE-RC. That's good.
Okay, so it's efficient and accurate.
Yes. But then they looked at the impact of using the denser variant sets, the 13 million and 18 million ones, and the finding was nuanced. For some models, like their standard VITRS-EM approach, using more variants did give small but consistent accuracy boosts, about 6% better on average, sometimes up to 9.5% better in East Asian samples within the UK Biobank.
Okay, so denser variants help sometimes.
But not always. Exactly. The models that were already performing best, specifically VIPRS-GS, the one with the built-in tuning, And Espeysar sees these top performers did not seem to get a significant accuracy boost on average from using those much denser variant sets, especially when looking at predictions across different ancestries within the UK Biobank.
Huh. So the best methods didn't really improve much just by adding more variants.
Largely no. And they saw similar patterns when they validated using the Cartagene data. Some marginal benefit for some models with denser variants, but the top-tier methods performed about the same whether they used 1.4 million or 18 million variants.
That's really significant. It kind of goes against the intuition that more data is always better. It implies that just jamming more variants into the model isn't the magic bullet for accuracy, at least not for the best current methods.
Precisely. That's a key takeaway. While more variants can help sometimes, the paper really suggests that how you build the model, the statistical assumptions, the algorithm used for inference, how well you tune those hyperparameters, plus, crucially, the quality of the input G DOBUS data and how well it matches the LD reference, those factors seem to have potentially a bigger impact on the final prediction accuracy than just sheer variant density, especially when you're trying to apply these scores across different populations.
Fascinating. Okay, that leads perfectly into the discussion and conclusions. What are the big implications here? Why should researchers or even eventually clinicians care about this work?
Well, maybe the biggest implication is about access. Democratizing the research, you could say. By making whole genome PRS calculations so much faster, needing so much less memory, less time, less need for supercomputers, it just makes this powerful tool accessible to way more researchers around the world.
Opens the door for labs that don't have massive compute clusters.
Exactly, and that enables deeper science. Researchers can now realistically look at the combined effects of all common variants together, not just a pre-selected subset they were forced to use because of computational limits. It allows for a more comprehensive view of genetic architecture.
And thinking longer term, PRSs are mostly research tools now, but what about clinical potential?
This is definitely a step in that direction. Making PRS calculation more accurate, more robust, and computationally feasible across diverse groups of people is absolutely necessary if these scores are ever going to be reliably used in personalized medicine for risk prediction or patient stratification. This work helps build that foundation.
And it sounds like the technical tricks you developed, the compressed matrices, the algorithms, could be useful beyond just PRS.
Oh, for sure. The authors point this out, too. Many of these improvements, the LD storage formats, the fast coordinate ascent, the stability tricks, even the PUMAS idea for tuning these, could be adapted for lots of other statistical genetics methods that wrestle with similar large-scale matrix computations. It pushes the whole field forward computationally.
Okay, so summing up the conclusions, Shadi Zabad and colleagues really delivered some major computational breakthroughs. They've shown it's now practical to do whole genome model-based PRS inference efficiently and accurately. They've cleared a huge hurdle.
Yep, basically showing you can work with tens of millions of variants without needing a dedicated supercomputer cluster, which is fantastic.
So here's a final thought for you, our listener, to chew on. Given their finding that just piling on more variants didn't automatically make the best PRS models more accurate, especially across different groups, where does the field go next? Is the next big leap in PRS going to come from even smarter statistical models, maybe incorporating things like functional data about what genes do? Or is the biggest gain still hiding in just getting better, more consistent, more harmonized genomic data from diverse populations around the globe? Something to think about.
Definitely food for thought. And just to reiterate, this base-by-base discussion was based on the open access article by Shadi Zabad and colleagues. The title is Toward Whole Genome Inference of Polygenic Scores with Fast and Memory-Efficient Algorithms, and it was published in the American Journal of Human Genetics in 2025. Because it's open access, it's available under a CC BY 4.0 license. You can find the DOI and a link to that license right there in the description for this discussion.